evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, September 15, 2020. A South Sudanese civil society leader is nominated for a peace award.
Is that sometimes when you talk to the parties and you speak, you know, truth to power, people seem to misunderstand you. And this is very sad that at the end of it all, the purpose is really for peace. But you know, with the warring parties, it's not always the case.
And some students in Juba react to directives to reopen schools.
If they open the school, we shall measure distancing in the class. Maybe you sit once in a day, another one will take in the next day. That is the way we shall be reducing this virus during the time we are in the classes.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese civil society activist is among 10 women from around the world who have been nominated by the United States Institute of Peace to receive a peace-building award to be announced in Washington Tuesday. Rita Lopidia Abraham, the CEO of EVE organization, says she's excited to be among the 10 nominees recognized for working to build peace in their countries. She says her work campaigning for women's inclusion in the South Sudan peace negotiations was not easy. Lopidia says she's disappointed at how South Sudanese leaders are too slow in implementing the peace agreement.
You know, being in the top 10 is not easy. So I am looking forward to the 15th to see how and what will come out of that.
Talk to me about your work. I remember seeing you in Addis Ababa and, sitting on the table with men at some point, you know, going head-on collision with men on matters to do with peace. Talk to me about your experience.
I think as many other South Sudanese, we were born and we grew up in conflict. And I grew up in Khartoum where I face discrimination because I'm coming from the South and because I'm a Christian and many others. I'm being considered as a second-class citizen in my then country. And this gave me the passion to start thinking of my country, of start thinking of South Sudan. And in the process, my friends and I formed EVE Organization for Women Development. And the purpose of the organization is really to work on helping women from South Sudan who are displaced in the Sudan. With the signing of the CPA in 2005, it gave us the hope and it motivated us as fresh graduates from the university, and it gave us a lot of excitement. We came back to South Sudan and we mobilized women during the census, and then the Sudan election, and then eventually the South Sudan referendum, where we felt proud that we are able to raise a flag for this country.
Let's talk about some of your sad moments during the negotiations in Khartoum. I spoke to several members of the signatories to the peace agreement, and some of them were saying that they were forced to sign this agreement or they were negotiating under threats. Talk to me about your experience.
Sad moments that I can highlight through the process is that sometimes when you talk to the parties and you speak, you know, truth to power, people seem to misunderstand you. And this is very sad that at the end of it all, the purpose is really for peace, but you know, with the warring parties, it's not always the case in terms of calling for peace. Secondly, when the negotiations were moved to Khartoum, it was also challenging things that the discussions were really limited to the parties level, and the civil society and the women groups only have limited access to the process. And it was also sad to see that as, you know, things were moving on, we realized that some of the gains that we had in the process, because we have not been around in other meetings, we realized that some aspects of it are being, you know, wiped off from or removed from the draft agreement. For instance, the participation of women in the different mechanisms we had to fight to ensure that there are a number of women represented in the different mechanisms for the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement.
Rita, it is an open secret that the environment for civil society leaders in South Sudan is very rough. At times, we've heard members of civil society groups being threatened. Could you share your experience?
I think, John Tanza, you will agree with me that in any peace processes or negotiations, people have always been rough. And I remember one of the delegates from one of the parties told me that, Rita, the peace negotiation is not for soft-hearted people. So if you are here and you are not strong and you want to cry, then the peace negotiation table is not a place for you. You have to just go to the church. So that summarizes the nature of negotiations or the nature of the peace table. People are rough, and if you have to, you know, put over your point, then you have to assert yourself. And in the process of asserting yourself, you will realize that you also step on people's feet, and that becomes a threat. I've mentioned before that when you speak truth to power, you tend to step on other people's feet, and it doesn't go well. And in many instances, it's not only me, but also other activists that we find it difficult to come back directly home. So you have to delay your stay in Addis or somewhere else for things to calm down before you come back to the country.
What are some of your success stories since you formed the EVE organization and working with women in South Sudan in matters to do with peace? Highlight some of your success.
John Tanza, I can highlight some of the successes that we have achieved through this journey. And I want to start way back. First of all, for me and my friends at a tender age, that we are fresh graduates and we were able to form a women's organization, for me, was the building block to all the other successes that we achieved. And the reason we formed EVE organization, as I mentioned, is because of what we have been through. As graduates in Sudan, we are not able to find jobs because we are from South Sudan, and we don't have the experience to get jobs in the NGOs because we are fresh graduates. But hey, we thought that, you know, we are graduates, we are learned, and we have the skills, so we can actually use the skills we have to help our people. And that's how we formed EVE organization. Our work during the Sudan's election to mobilize women, especially in central Equatoria and in eastern Equatoria, contributed to the results of the election. And the biggest achievement is, you know, mobilizing women to come out in numbers during the referendum. In the era of the independence and when the country went into conflict, EVE also, we found ourselves at the forefront calling for cessation of hostilities, calling for the parties to sit down and negotiate. And that's how we ended up in corridors in Addis and in New York and in Washington and in Djibouti, calling for refrain and restrain from the parties and asking them to come to the peace table, but also having women into the process.
That's Rita Lopidia Abraham, CEO of the EVE organization. She spoke with me from Juba over the weekend. South Sudan has exempted aid agencies from movement restrictions imposed in the country due to COVID-19. The incident manager for COVID-19 at the National Ministry of Health says aid agencies will not be required to take a coronavirus test or present a COVID-19 free certificate before traveling for work in various parts of the country. The chief of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs says other challenges, including insecurity, continue to harm the work of aid agencies across South Sudan. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
Dr. Richard Laku, the COVID-19 incident manager at the South Sudan's Health Ministry, says aid workers will no longer be required to get tested and present a COVID-19 free certificate before traveling from one state to another. But Dr. Laku says aid workers arriving in the country will still need to undergo a 14-day quarantine. After that, as long as the worker is COVID-19 free, they can carry on with their work as normal.
We are not able to cope up with the number of people who are traveling internally and externally, and also the pressure on the load. So that's why we force people to be quarantined. Because being quarantined means you have isolated yourself from people, you are not getting in touch with people for these 14 days, definitely, then you will be safer than those who are not quarantined.
Dr. Laku says the health ministry recognizes the threat posed by COVID-19 but does not view the pandemic as the biggest health threat to South Sudanese lives.
COVID is just one problem in health. We have more than other health problems that are also killing. If you see malaria, this is a season for malaria. And if you don't take drugs to people to the rural areas, to have 100 people, we lose more than nearly 40, especially children. With COVID, if we have 100, we lose maybe 5, 6, or 7. So you can see even that other health problems kills more than COVID, although COVID is spread so fast.
Esther Ben-Sako, the head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says while the movement restriction has been lifted, other challenges continue for humanitarians, including insecurity in parts of the country, even though a unity government was formed. This year alone, Sako says, UN OCHA has registered more than a dozen insecurity threats, including ambushes on convoys of aid workers.
We have in certain parts of the countries that, regardless that the country has unified, you know, the authorities in those areas still working, you know, as a, you know, and they still coming up with legislation that they are not reflecting the national policy on recruitment, you know, on registration of NGOs, you know, on renewal of working permit of NGOs. So they're having these, you know, outrageous demand on aid organizations working in remote areas that are not linked with the law, you know, of the land.
Sako also says flooding in parts of the country makes it difficult for aid workers to access people who need help. Aid workers in Ayot recently had to be relocated due to flooding, according to Sako. Delays caused by government bureaucracy also slows down the work of humanitarians, says Sako.
We have a lot of delays, you know, in processing visas, processing renewal of visas for people who are coming back into the country, you know, and again, this is our staff that are critical to the response. So a fast tracking on visa processes or renewal of visas will be really welcome.
According to the latest UN OCHA humanitarian report, 7.5 million people across South Sudan are in need of aid, including nearly 6.5 million people who are acutely food insecure. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The chairperson of the Education Committee in South Sudan's National Assembly says the government's decision to reopen schools could expose children to COVID-19. Some students in Juba have welcomed the decision to reopen schools. For VOA News, Manyang David Mayar reports from Juba.
The cabinet has decided that all the higher institutes of learning and the schools should be open. And as to when, this will be determined by the ministers of higher education and the minister of general education. But the schools should be open.
That is Information Minister Michael McQuay speaking last Friday to reporters shortly after the weekly Council of Ministers meeting. 18-year-old Williams Locke, a senior forest student at Sopiri Secondary School in Juba, says staying at home during the COVID-19 lockdown has been boring, so he is happy to go to class again.
We went home for the issue of corona, and then now many people, especially girls and boys, they dropped. Others, they are criminals. Because now the school can guide us. You stay from school from morning, maybe up to once. You go back. You go and consider on your books. But now, during the time when there's no school, you are just there sitting at home, nothing to do. I think even sometimes you go and do something bad.
Locke says some of his friends have become parents during the lockdown. When he returns to school, Locke says he will follow all preventive measures.
If they open the school, we shall measure distancing in the class. Maybe you sit once in a day, another one will take in the next day. That is the way we shall be reducing this virus during the time we are in the classes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then even by the time when we are going back for breaks, we shall be even using social distance. You may not be near to your... I think even if everyone could come with the mask, it should be okay.
The National Assembly's Education Committee Chairman, Musa Mohamed, says overcrowded classes in a majority of South Sudan's schools will increase the risk of spreading the coronavirus across the country when schools reopen.
Not any school which have less than 100 in a class. We are having more. Then how can we keep the rules and regulation of COVID-19, which tell us that we have to keep distancing? We have to divide the class at least into three.
Mohamed says even if school administrators are able to divide each class into two or three to ensure social distancing, the managers of public and private schools will have to figure out how to pay teacher salaries.
The government should release money as quickly as possible to the teachers so that they can afford standing before a student.
South Sudan's General Education Minister Awud Deng Achwil says her ministry is assessing the needs of schools across the country to ensure that COVID-19 preventive measures are put in place.
We have to know whether we have sanitation in those schools. We have to know how many schools need to be disinfected before our children get into these facilities. So the protocol from the Minister of Health has to be followed a step by step, so that our children and our teachers and our family where these children come from are saved.
Some school administrators in Juba say they are excited about the decision to reopen schools and will comply with all COVID-19 preventive measures. Jock Abraham Thorn, director of Promised Land Secondary School in Juba, says he has installed water facilities for children to wash their hands as they enter the school premises.
We were even producing our liquid soap for the students to wash their hands as a fight against COVID-19. So as a school, we are ready and we shall continue to do our best to keep the measures of the COVID-19. We have all the notice of the awareness in the classrooms as students read the guideline daily for their benefits and their families' benefits as well.
While public school administrators say they are ready for schools to reopen, some parents say they are worried the virus will spread among students and teachers. Juba parent Mike Duku has mixed feelings about the decision to reopen schools.
I recognize that it's very important for children to go to school, and they have really missed a lot during this time, and there are a lot of problems associated with them when they're out of school. But on the other side, there's still prevalence of the COVID situation. The coronavirus is still present. If you go to some of our primary schools, you find that they are very, very compact in a small room because of lack of space. How are the schools going to handle this kind of stuff?
As of September 13th, South Sudan had 2,587 confirmed cases of the virus. 49 people have died from the virus since June. For VOA News, I'm Anyang David Mayar in Juba.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, abortion debate heats up in Malawi. Stay tuned for that story after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you reward yourself?
I'll go and buy myself maybe a pair of shoes I always desire to get. I'll go and have a meal I always desire to get. Or anything. Depends on what I've achieved.
By spoiling myself. I'm a girl. I go buy myself clothes, shoes, do my hair, my nails. Basic things that will make me look good and happy at the end of the day.
I cook a good meal. I sit down with a chill drink.
My work involves very hard work, so I get very tired. So I reward myself once every month. I do that by swimming and relaxing at the beach with my family.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. In our Tuesday health segment, we look at abortion debate in Malawi. Anti-abortion activists in Malawi are protesting plans by the National Assembly to debate a bill that would allow abortion in cases of rape and incest. Malawi's abortion rights activists argue the pregnancy termination bill would help prevent the 12,000 deaths annually from illegal and safe abortions. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Abortion is currently illegal in Malawi and punishable by a maximum of 14 years in prison, except in cases where pregnancy threatens the life of a woman. Proponents of the termination of pregnancy bill says the restriction is forcing women to seek illegal abortion services, mostly from untrained personnel. Government statistics indicated that 70,000 women in Malawi have illegal abortions each year, and 17% of them die from the procedure. Dr. Amos Nyaka is vice chair for the Coalition for Prevention of Unsafe Abortion, which is championing liberalized abortion laws in Malawi.
From the public health point of view, I think it would be important to address this issue of complications that arise from termination of pregnancies. And I think that's why I think it's important that this be discussed and it be looked at in terms of how we can protect women from dying from terminations of pregnancies.
The bill would also allow victims of rape under age 6 and incest to end their pregnancies. At a press conference Monday, anti-abortion activists, mostly religious groups, asked the National Assembly not to discuss the bill, which is expected to be presented during the current sitting of Parliament. Thomas Nsusa is the chairperson for the Episcopal Conference of Malawi. He says the government should not champion the measure, which he says promotes killings.
But if anything, they don't really listen to what they are saying. For sure, we will not remain silent. We will call for another course of action, whether that would be the same as what we did in 2016 or another way of doing things until what God calls us for should be listened.
In 2016, a group of anti-abortion activists led by the Catholic Church marched to Parliament to stop lawmakers from discussing the legislation. Brian Banda is the presidential press secretary. He told reporters in the capital, Lilongwe, Monday, that President Lazarus Chakwera cannot prevent Parliament from discussing the measure.
What the president is saying, people that have views against this bill, they should discuss. Being a private member's bill, they should lobby members of Parliament on how they should deal with this matter.
The lawmakers are expected to debate the bill before the current sitting of Parliament ends on October 23. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
The Sudanese Authority for Antiquities and Museums says some ancient sites could be affected by floods. Sudanese officials say water from the floods has reached some parts of the city of Morowe, an ancient city on the eastern bank of the River Nile. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Antiquities expert Umaima Hasaba Rasul, who works with the Sudan National Museum in Khartoum, says some western part of the royal city, including the royal bathroom basin, has been affected by the floods. Hasaba Rasul says antiquities expert with the colleges of Khartoum, Nilen and Shendi universities are working to block the flood waters from entering the ancient site.
This is an unfortunate incident where these sites are under the threat of being covered up by flood water. At some point, the water level has reached up to 30 centimeters on part of the wall. We had to call for communal intervention. Through the administration of various colleges and other partners, we were able to put more blocks to prevent water. So up to now, we can only say the level of the threat has reduced a little bit.
The Marawi royal city was the capital of the Kush kingdom, established in 590 before Christ, which represents a series of early states located within the Middle Nile, now part of Sudan. It is one of the earliest and most impressive states found south of the Sahara. The area was registered under UNESCO as one of the world's heritage sites in early 2000. Hasaba Rasul says the site is important not only in Sudan's history, but in the African continent and the entire world. She says the Marawi royal city shows how the Sudanese people contributed to human civilization.
The building reflects how Sudan during the Marawi period was open to the world around. They had ties with the Mediterranean Sea's culture. On the wall inside the building, there are graphics that shows and express Roman, Greek, and Egypt cultures.
Speaking to reporters late last week after visiting the site, Sudan's Information Minister Faisal Muhammad Saleh said the site tells the story of the Sudanese heritage and culture as it contains archaeological evidence for the Marawi Kingdom.
The building contains the Amun God's temple. It also has the royal bathroom, which is very unique. When the ongoing renovations finish soon, we hope it will be open for the public and visitors. People will realize its beauty and its historical meaning.
Saleh acknowledges the previous administration neglected important historical Sudanese sites like this one for more than 30 years. He says the transitional government plans to do something about it.
We shall be announcing a national fundraising program for all Sudanese citizens, government, companies and businesses so that we renovate the royal city. We should be all proud of these antiquities as we are heading towards achieving lasting peace in the country. Our history should unite all of us, and the world should know Sudan's ancient history through its antiquities.
The Marawi also has more than 100 pyramids, parts of the largest group of Nubian pyramids. Officials warn that, for the first time in the history, the pyramids are threatened by flooding. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We would like to welcome our listeners on 99.9 FM at Kakuma Refugee Camp in Kenya who are enjoying good programs on a new VOA FM station at the camp. Thanks to the VOA management for caring about refugees. We now leave you with the song Born in Africa by Philip Bongoli. Been listening to Philip Bongoli with the song Born in Africa. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for allowing us into your homes, phones, and vehicles. Remember to wash your hands with soap. Practice social distancing. Wear a mask if you must leave your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.